This is the current federal tax developments for the week of February 23, 2015. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. We're going to take a look this week at the continuing IRS relief that we received in another area, plus some other interesting developments that have occurred during this week in the area of federal taxes. We're going to begin here with a special IRS news release that was issued at the beginning of this week that dealt with the issue of some scam emails that are being aimed at tax professionals. Now, recently we had discussed some emails that were aimed at clients that were attempting to get information from clients to steal identities and take other nasty actions based on the client clicking through on an email that they shouldn't. Now the IRS has discovered that there have been emails targeted at tax professionals that have come from the IRS that tell you that you need to update information about your EFIN for electronic filing and your e-services account, threatening dire consequences if you do not do so timely. The problem is, of course, that if you click through that link, you'll be taken to a site that looks like the IRS's e-services site, but is not actually that site. And the bad guys will, at that point, start to obtain various information from you, including your credentials for getting onto e-services. Now, as you can imagine, there's a lot of nefarious things that could happen at that point that someone could do in control of a professional's e-services credentials. The IRS rules or tells us very, very strongly not to click on such emails and especially not to follow up and put such information in. Now, unfortunately, that's useful advice for this scam, but it's not terribly useful advice for avoiding being caught in the future, because we certainly can expect that these guys will move on to the next thing and certain situations will arise that will attempt to trick tax professionals into providing access to their networks or to access to things like IRS e-services. So you really need to make sure your staff is aware of what is good and safe electronic computer communication use. One real problem we have is you cannot really tell when you click through on an email whether you are going to the site that claims you are going to be going to when you, according to the email that says we're going to send you over here to this other site. Those emails will look very, very professional. They will look as if they come from the organization that is threatening dire action, and they will attempt to get you to move quickly because it will threaten some dire action if you do not act. One simple rule that you should follow is, and you should train your staff, never, ever, ever click on a link in an email that asks you to do something unless you have specifically requested that that something be done. That is, if you call up and say, I need to reset my password and talk to somebody at an organization, and then right following that you get a reset email, a reset password email, that's probably okay to click on. But if out of the blue you get a notice that we need you to go update your account, please click here, you really need to go ahead and go up to the address bar and simply type in the URL of the site in question. The reality is that there are various ways of lying. The simplest way is to just hide behind the HTML coding of the email, the place you're actually going to go. But there are ways, even if you think, oh, I've got that covered, I can hover over it, see the tooltip, and it'll tell me where I'm going. There are even ways using JavaScript in email to have, when you click, it won't go to the link that appears it would go to. Rather, there'll be an on-click function in JavaScript that will send it somewhere else. So again, be very, very, very suspicious whenever you get an email asking you to click on a link, especially one that asks you to provide information. You need to communicate to your staff and you need to communicate to your clients about the importance of not falling for these scams. In Notice 2015-13, the IRS talked about procedures for getting Work Opportunity Credit certification for employees that were hired during 2014 who qualify for the targeted groups. Now, as you may be aware, Congress extended the Work Opportunity Credit under Section 51 on December 19th as part of the Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2014. Unfortunately, under Section 51, you're told that before you can get a credit for somebody, when you hire them, they either have to be pre-certified by the state employment agency, or you have to ask for certification within 28 days after you hire them, and you must have completed the checklist before you hire them. Now, of course, the problem was, for virtually all of 2015, we didn't have this credit, and therefore we didn't have certification programs that were taking place or ways to get the certification in place. Now, suddenly Congress extends this at the end of 2015, Congress does not actually fix this problem. It's amazing considering that Congress creates this problem every couple of years, or this time they'll create it again at the end of 15. Congress does not provide a way to fix this otherwise, but the IRS has issued Notice 2015-13 that will allow you to get certification for anybody hired during 2014 so long as you submit the application to the state agency by April 30th. Now, the ruling warns you that you still have to wait to receive certification from the state agency before you can claim the credit. So if you've been on a fiscal year and you've already filed your return, or maybe you were very quick and got your calendar year return filed, you're going to have to amend, but you can't amend until you get certification. For those who have not yet filed, you are supposed to wait for the certification before you file the return claiming the credit. If you're going to run out of time, you file the return without the credit, and then you'll have to amend to claim the credit. Again, details on handling this are found in Notice 2015-13. Now we're going to get to the new relief provision that Congress gave us this year. Not Congress, I say, but the IRS gave us regarding issues that arose for times when employers have reimbursed the health insurance premiums of employees that were individual policies. Quite a few small taxpayers had made use of the provision of Revenue Ruling 61-146. That old ruling, still very valid more than 50 years later, holds that you can exclude from employees' income or exclude from their W-2 amounts that you pay even though it's being paid to an individual policy for the employee. That counts as an employer plan. The employer gets a deduction up front. That ruling is still perfectly valid, as I mentioned, but there is a problem. The Affordable Care Act added additional requirements for employer-sponsored plans. Now, under the Public Health Service Act, if you do not meet all the requirements that the PHS imposes, then Internal Revenue Code 4980D, if you don't meet certain requirements, imposes a $100 per employee per day penalty for while you are maintaining this non-compliant plan. In Notice 2013-54, the IRS provided that generally, if you were reimbursing an employee for individual coverage, that is coverage issued under the individual market, that would fail to qualify. The problem is this. Under the Affordable Care Act, all employer-sponsored programs must meet the market reform provisions. There are two key parts of those provisions. Number one, the first one says there can be no limit on lifetime benefits nor limit on annual benefits under a program. And number two, you must provide preventive care at no cost to the employee. The IRS ruled, and Notice 2013-54 continues, that you can, in essence, paying premiums is an employer program, and because you are limiting premiums to the amount of the premium, that's a cap on benefits. However, if you are paying premiums on a group plan, you're allowed to integrate. So your payments under your reimbursement arrangement, and in this case, reimbursing health insurance premiums is considered a reimbursement arrangement, can be integrated with an insurance program. But the caveat is it must be a group program. If you try to pay the premiums for an individual policy, you're not allowed to integrate. So even though the individual policy today to be offered has to provide no lifetime limits on benefits and has to provide no annual limits, also provide those preventive care options, the problem you run into is you can't integrate that. So if your reimbursement program does not by itself give an unlimited reimbursement for medical expenses and give preventive care for free, which by no means are you likely to offer those two options, especially because then we get into a question with the insurance carrier as well about who had primary coverage, and so you get to pay for that quadruple bypass out of the company funds, not something most employers would want. You end up with a program in violation and a $100 per day penalty. Well, a lot of people hadn't paid much attention to that, and in fact, notice only really started going around quite heavily, and we got a lot of comments right after the beginning of January as people began to notice this. So the IRS now has offered certain relief. This particular relief goes into a number of provisions. Number one, the IRS has provided generally that if you are not a large employer, the applicable large employers, those people who have to pay or play this year in 2015, if you're not an applicable large employer, the IRS will not impose penalties for a program that reimburses insurance premiums under the rules of notice of revenue ruling, I should say, 61-146, so long as you basically clean up your act by the 1st of July. So there'll be no penalty imposed on this program from the end of June through the 1st of July. After the 1st of July, though, the penalties may become, you may become subject to such penalties at that point. Now, there is an exception if your program covers, and the way the code's worded is this, fewer than two current employees. We would normally call that one. If that is true, then your program's not covered by the $100 per day penalty, and you can continue to pay it. So if you have a true one-person C corporation paying for medical insurance, then we have no problem. We don't have to worry about this rule even after the 1st of July. Secondly, the IRS knows that we have notice 2008-1 regarding reimbursement of premiums for S-corporation shareholders. They have given us a special rule for S-corporation shareholders. In addition to our general coverage here through the end of June, until the IRS issues further notice, you can continue to reimburse S-corporation shareholders for individual policies and count that as self-employed health insurance rather than W-2 and not be subject to the $100 per day penalty. Now, there is a caveat to this. That person still kind of counts for purposes of determining if you have no more than two employees. So while you could have 20 shareholders, each one would be a 5% owner, let's say, under this plan, and on July 1st, if the IRS doesn't issue further guidance, we're not going to be penalized for those 20. A single employee who is being reimbursed who was not an owner, wasn't a 2% owner, that person would be subject to, you'd be subject to as the employer, the $100 per day penalty or $36,500 per day, I should say per year penalty on reimbursing that person's premiums. So the S corporations are special rules. The notice also provides special rules on how you could integrate Social Security, or I should say Medicare, into the program. Generally, reimbursement of Medicare premiums is also prohibited under these rules. However, they give you a structure where if you're offering group coverage and you meet certain criteria, you may still reimburse an employee's Medicare premiums, but only if there is an offer of qualifying coverage and you meet other criteria. The notice warns you that structuring such a program may also cause you issues with some other rules that apply to Medicare and how Medicare relates to employer programs under the Medicare rules that have been in place for many years. A similar set of rules apply to TRICARE beneficiaries. Those generally are U.S. military who are receiving benefits from the U.S. military under the TRICARE program. You also can reimburse those if you are part of a general employer program that meets all the criteria of Notice 2015-17. Now, in all these cases, the IRS has indicated they expect to issue future guidance, and you should be aware and keep an eye on that future guidance. But I would certainly say that you need to start getting your programs and your clients ready for a potential change by July 1st. In essence, you now have a second chance to become compliant. More relief issues coming up here, but not in general. This is Notice 2015-08021. This is the missed rollover because we're trying to avoid some fees. In this case, the taxpayer transferred an IRA to a bank. The bank said, oh, I see in your brokerage account you're holding these various investments. The bank won't be able to hold those investments. So if you just have them transfer the investments over to the bank directly from the brokerage account, you're going to be charged a fee for selling those investments because the bank's going to charge you for the extra cost it's going to incur for going through sales of those. So the bank person told her what you should do is close out that account and get everything in cash and make a cash contribution. So you'll get a check. That check will then essentially, you'll then deposit that within 60 days into our account. The person went to the brokerage firm, told them they wanted to close out the account. They were told it was going to take 2 to 3 months to do so because of the nature of the investments in the account. The nature of those investments is probably part of the reason why the bank was going to charge a fee in order to close out the account. So the person says, well, go ahead and do what you have to do. The brokerage firm, as they sold each investment, issued checks to the taxpayer. These checks were issued from basically mid-October through the end of December. In late January, this person goes to the bank now to deposit their funds for the rollover. That, of course, is a problem because they've received 6 different checks, and a number of those checks were issued more than 60 days earlier, opening up a slew of problems with completing a valid rollover And so the bank says, wait, they notice the problem. They contact the brokerage firm. There's a stop payment put on the check. The brokerage firm has already issued a 1099-R for that amount. But what the brokerage firm does, they're going to indicate a 5498, since the funds never really left the account, that there was a rollover back into the brokerage account of the cash. Now the taxpayer is asking for relief from the IRS for having blown the 60-day period. The IRS in this case decides the taxpayer had reasonably relied on the advice of the brokerage firm, interestingly enough, because they had told the brokerage firm what they were planning to do, roll cash into the IRA at the bank. The employee of the brokerage account had told them, you know, knew what was happening, executed this, set it up in a way where it didn't work, did not inform this person about the 60-day rules and the problem when that first check came out, we're going to have an issue. So the employee, the beneficiary, it was allowed an extra 60 days, basically, or the waiver of the late rollover. Now, of course, we're going to presume, since it's all in cash in the brokerage account, we can now transfer the cash account into the bank with no problem. But it was a long way around. Next up, we have an issue here with the estate. Estate failed to permanently set aside funds. This is the estate of Belmont. Estates generally can get a deduction under Section 642 if they set aside funds permanently for a charitable use. Now, this estate was basically set up so $50,000 went to the decedent's brother, and the balance went to a charity. The charity had sold off all the other assets, but there was a condominium that the brother had been living in. The brother claimed that he and his sister had an agreement that he had a life estate to live in the condo in Santa Monica. The estate claimed no such thing issued, and the charity had no interest in holding real estate. So the estate asked the brother to leave. Now, around this time, this was all taking place right at the end of the first fiscal year of the estate. The estate gave the information to the CPA to prepare the return, did not tell the CPA that the brother had refused the offer, and in fact, shortly after the end of the fiscal year, March 31st, the brother had started the process of filing legal claims to establish his right. The estate claimed a deduction for effectively the net because one of the assets the estate had received was a distribution from retirement account, therefore had income in that year equal to the amount of the retirement account. So they claimed a deduction equal to the net received from the retirement account as funds permanently set aside for charitable purposes because the residuary went to charity. The IRS claimed, wait a minute, and in fact what really happened was the brother and the estate got in long litigation over whether the brother had to leave. Eventually the brother was awarded a right by a court in California to stay in that location. But because this of extended period of fight, not only were there legal fees incurred by this estate, which by the way the decedent was an Ohio resident and this property was in California, so we had a secondary probate running, but in fact because they kept it open, they incurred a lot of expenses simply from keeping the estate open. And by the time they were done, there were fewer funds left in the estate than there had been the amount claimed as a deduction. The estate claimed that they could not reasonably have foreseen the fact there'd be this fight. The IRS claimed, guys, no, you're wrong. It was easy to reasonably foresee that the brother was going to fight. The tax court, ruling for the first time on this particular issue with regard to an estate, held that it was clear from facts and circumstances the estate should have been aware of the high possibility that the brother would raise a fight. And so because of that, the funds could not be declared to be permanently set aside, even though the full residuary of the estate was going to charity. Therefore, the estate was denied a deduction in that year that they received the distribution from the retirement plan for the charitable contribution. Finally, the IRS in Notice 2015-15, if you have to file for refund claims on overwithheld FICA, for instance, all of you that may have paid for employee transportation costs, that Congress retroactively increased the amount excludable, so you'd overwithheld FICA, now you're filing claims for refund. You have to get consents before you can do that because you withheld the FICA, so you have to pay it back to the employee and receive a consent. The IRS in Notice 2015-15 gave us some guidance on how to receive those consents. There is a proposed revenue procedure in there for obtaining electronic consents for employer payroll tax refunds. If you wish to go down that route, you can take a look in Notice 2015-15. While you don't have to use the proposed revenue procedure, the IRS does provide that you can rely upon that. So if you wish to use electronic means to get that sort of consents, this is clearly the way you should be doing it at this point in time. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of February the 23rd, 2015. If you want to find out more information about what we talked about or keep up with developments during the week, we post information and links related to these things we discuss on the website currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Go there. You can get information. You can also get links to this information. We'll see you next week when we'll talk again about what's happened in the upcoming week in the area of federal taxes.